He did, however, reply.
"You came not a moment too soon," he said.
"Auto-crucifixion," Gentle replied.
"Now that would be a miracle."
Athanasius turned to him. His face was sallow and his forehead bloody. He looked at the scabs on Gentle's brow and shook his head.
"Two of a kind," he said.
Then he raised his hands. The palms bore unmistakable marks.
"Have you got these too?"
"No. And these," Gentle pointed to his forehead, "aren't what you think. Why do you do this to yourself?"
"I didn't do it," Athanasius replied. "I woke up with these wounds. Believe me, I don't welcome them."
Gentle's face registered his skepticism, and Athanasius responded with vim.
"I've never wanted any of this," he said. "Not the stigmata, not the dreams."
"So why were you looking at the tree?"
"I'm hungry," came the reply, "and I was wondering if I had the strength to climb."
The gaze directed Gentle's attention back to the tree. Amid the foliage on the higher branches were clusters of comet-ripened fruit, like zebra tangerines.
"I can't help you, I'm afraid," Gentle said. "I don't have enough substance to catch hold of them. Can't you shake them down?"
"I tried."
"Never mind. We've got more important business than my belly."
"Finding you bandages, for one," Gentle said. His suspicions chastened out of him by this misunderstanding, at least for the moment.
"I don't want you bleeding to death before we begin the reconciliation."
"You mean these?" he said, looking at his hands. "No, it stops and starts whenever it wants. I'm used to it."
"Well then, we should at least find you something to eat. Have you tried any of the houses?"
"I'm not a thief."
"I don't think anybody's coming back, Athanasius. Let's find you some sustenance before you pass out."
They went to the nearest house, and after a little encouragement from Gentle, who was surprised to find such moral nicety in his companion, Athanasius kicked open the door. The house had either been looted or vacated in haste, but the kitchen had been left untouched and was well stocked. There Athanasius daintily prepared himself a sandwich with his wounded hands, bloodying the bread as he did so.
"I've such a hunger on me," he said. "I suppose you've been fasting, have you?"
"No. Was I supposed to?"
"Each to their own," Athanasius replied. "Everybody walks to heaven by a different road. I knew a man who couldn't pray unless he had his loins in a zazai nest."
Gentle winced.
"That's not religion. That's masochism."
"And masochism isn't a religion," the other replied. "You surprise me."
Gentle was startled to find that Athanasius had a capacity for wit, and found himself warming to the man as they chatted. Perhaps they could profit from each other's company after all, though any truce would be cosmetic if the subject of the erasure and all that had happened there wasn't broached.
"I owe you an explanation," he said.
"Oh?"
"For what happened at the tents. You lost a lot of your people, and it was because of me."
"I don't see how you could have handled it much differently," Athanasius said. "Neither of us knew the forces we were dealing with."
"I'm not sure I do now."
Athanasius made a grim face.
"Pai Opa went to a good deal of trouble to come back and haunt you," he said.
"It wasn't a haunting."
"Whatever it was, it took will to do it. The Mystiff must have known what the consequences would be for itself and for my people."
"It hated to cause harm."
"So what was so important that it caused so much?"
"It wanted to make certain I understood my purpose."
"That's not reason enough,"
Athanasius said. "It's the only one I've got," Gentle replied, skirting the other part of Pi's message, the part about Sartori. Athanasius had no answers to such puzzles, so why vex him with them?
"I believe there's something going on we don't understand," Athanasius said. "Have you seen the waters?"
"Yes."
"Don't they perturb you? They do me. There are other powers at work here besides us, Gentle. Maybe we should be seeking them out, taking their advice."
"What do you mean by powers? Other maestros?"
"No, I mean the Holy Mother. I think she may be here in Isorderex."
"But you're not certain?"
"Something's moving the waters."
"If she was here, wouldn't you know it?
You were one of her high priests."
"I was never that. We worshipped at the erasure because there was a crime committed there. A woman was taken from that spot into the first."
Locus Tado had told Gentle this story as they'd driven across the desert. but with so much else to vex and excite him, he'd forgotten the tale. His mother's, of course. Her name was Celestine, wasn't it?
How do you know?
Because I've met her. She's still alive. Back in the Fifth. The other man narrowed his eyes, as though to sharpen his gaze and prick this if it was a lie. But after a few moments a tiny smile appeared.
So you've had dealings with holy women, he said. There's hope for you yet.
You can meet her yourself when all this is over.
I'd like that.
But for now we have to hold to our course. There can be no deviations, do you understand? We can go looking for the Holy Mother when the reconciliation's done, but not before.
I feel so damn naked,
Athanasius said. We all do. It's inevitable. But there's something more inevitable still.
What's that?
The wholeness of things, Gentle said. Things mended, things healed. That's more certain than sin or death or darkness.
Well said, Athanasius replied. Who taught you that?
You should know. You married me to it.
Ah,
he smiled.
Then may I remind you why a man marries, so that he can be made whole by a woman.
Not this man, Gentle said.
Wasn't the mischief a woman to you?
Sometimes.
And when it wasn't?
It was neither man nor woman. It was bliss. Athanasius looked intensely discomforted by this.
That sounds profane to me, he remarked.
Gentle had never thought of the bond between himself and the mischief in such terms before, nor did he welcome the burden of such doubts now. Pi had been his teacher, his friend, and his lover, a selfless champion of the reconciliation from the very beginning. He could not believe that his father would ever have sanctioned such a liaison if it were anything but holy.
I think we should let the subject lie, he told Athanasius, or we'll be at each other's throats again, and I, for one, don't want that.
Neither do I, Athanasius replied. We'll not discuss it any further. Tell me, where do you go from here?
To the Erasure.
And who represents the synod there?
Chica Jackeen.
Ah, so you chose him, did you?
You know him?
Not well. I know he came to the Erasure long before I did. In fact, I don't think anyone quite knew how long he'd been there. He's a strange fellow.
If that were a disqualification, we'd both be out of a job, Gentle remarked.
True enough.
With that, Gentle offered Athanasius his good wishes, and they parted civilly, if not fondly, Gentle turning his thoughts from his Isordrex to the desert beyond. Instantly, the domestic interior flickered and was replaced, seconds later, by the vast wall of the Erasure, rising from a fog in which he dearly hoped the last member of his synod was awaiting him. 4. The streams kept converging as the women climbed, until they were walking beside a flow that would soon be too wide to leap and too furious to ford. There were no embankments to contain these waters, only the gullies and gutters of the street, but the same intentionality that drew them up the hill also limited their lateral spread. That way the river didn't dissipate its energies, but climbed like an animal whose skin was growing at a prodigious rate to accommodate the power it gained every time it assimilated another of its kind. By now its destination would not be in doubt. There was only one structure on the city's highest peak, the Autarch's Palace, and unless an abyss opened up in the street and swallowed the waters before they reached the gates, it would be there that the trail would deliver them. Jude had mixed memories of the palace. Some, like the pivot tower and the chamber of sluiced prayers beneath it, were terrifying. Others were sweetly erotic, like the hours she'd spent dozing in Quaeswa's bed while Concupiscentia sang, and the lover she'd thought too perfect to be real had covered her with kisses. He was gone, of course, but she would be returning into the labyrinth he'd built, now turned to some new purpose, not only with the scent of him upon her. You smell of coitus, Celestine had said, but with the fruit of that coupling in her womb. Her hope of sharing wisdom with Celestine had undoubtedly been blighted by that fact. Even after Tay's disparagement and Clem's conciliation, the woman had contrived to treat Jude as a pariah. And if she, merely brushed by divinity, had sniffed Sartori on Jude's skin, then surely Tishalule would sniff the same, and know the child was there too. If challenged, Jude had decided to tell the truth. She had reasons for doing all that she'd done, and she would not make false apologies, but come to the altars of these goddesses with humility and self-respect in equal measure. The gates were now in view, the river gushing towards them, its flood a white water roar. Either its assault or some previous violence had thrown both gates off their hinges, and the water surged through the gap ecstatically.
"How do we get through?" Hoipala yelled above the din.
"It's not that deep," Jude said. "We'll be able to wade it if we go together. Here, take my hand." Without giving the girl time to argue or retreat, she took firm hold of Hoipala's wrist and stepped into the river. As she'd said, it wasn't very deep. Its spumy surface only climbed to the middle of their thighs, but there was considerable force in it, and they were obliged to proceed with extreme care. Jude couldn't see the ground she was leading them over, the water was too wild, but she could feel through her soles how the river was digging up the paving, eroding in a matter of minutes what the tread of soldiers, slaves, and penitents had not much impressed in 2 centuries. Nor was this erosion the only threat to their equilibrium. The river's freight of arms, petitions, and trash was very heavy now, gathered as it was from 5 or 6 places in the lower Kesperates. Slabs of wood knocked at their hamstrings and shins, swaths of cloth wrapped around their knees, but Jude remained sure-footed and advanced with a steady tread until they were through the gates, glancing back over her shoulder now and then to reassure Hoipala with a look or a smile that, though there was discomfort here, there was no great hazard. The river didn't slow once it was inside the palace walls. Instead, it seemed to find fresh impetus, its spume thrown ever higher as it climbed through the courtyards. The comet's beams were falling here in greater abundance than on the Kesperates below, and their light, striking the water, threw silver filigrees up against the joyless stone. Distracted by the beauty of this, Jude momentarily lost her footing as they cleared the gates, and, despite a cry of warning, fell back into the river, taking Hoipala with her. Though they were in no danger of drowning, the water had sufficient momentum to carry them along, and Hoipala, being much the lighter of the two, was swept past Jude at some speed. Their attempts to stand up again were defeated by the eddies and countercurrents its enthusiasm was generating, and it was only by chance that Hoipala, thrown against a dam of detritus that was choking part of the flow, was able to use its accrued bulk to bring herself to a halt and haul herself to her knees. The water broke against her with considerable vehemence as she did so, its will to carry her off undiminished, but she defied it, and by the time Jude was carried to the place, Hoipala was getting to her feet.
"Give me your hand!"
she yelled, returning the invitation Jude had first offered when they stepped into the flood. Jude reached to do so, half turning in the water to stretch for Hoipala's fingers, but the river had other ideas. As their hands came within inches of clasping, the waters conspired to spin her and snatch her away, their hold on her so tight the breath was momentarily squeezed out of her. She couldn't even yell a word of reassurance, but was hauled off by the flood, up through a monolithic archway and out of sight. Violent as the waters were, pitching her around as it raced through the cloisters and colonnades, she wasn't in fear of them, quite the opposite. The exhilaration was contagious. She was part of their purpose now, even if they didn't know it, and happy to be delivered to their summoner, who was surely also their source. Whether that summoner, be she Tishalule or Jokalelau or any other goddess who might be resident here today, judged her to be a petitioner or simply another piece of trash, only the end of this ride would tell. 5. If Isorderex had become a place of glorious particulars, every colour singing, every bubble in its waters crystalline, the erasure had given itself over to ambiguity. There was no breath of wind to stir the heavy mist that hung over the fallen tents and over the dead, shrouded but unburied, who lay in their folds. Nor did the comet have far enough to pierce a higher fog, the fabric of which left its light dusky and drab. Off to the left of where Gentle's projection stood, the ring of Madonnas that Athanasius and his disciples had sheltered in was visible through the murk, but the man he'd come here to find wasn't in residence there, nor was there any sign of him to the right, though here the fog was so thick it blotted out everything that lay beyond an 8 or 10 yard range. He nevertheless headed into it, loath to try calling Chica Jackeen's name, even if his voice had possessed sufficient strength. There was a conspiracy of suppression upon the landscape, and he was unwilling to challenge it. Instead, he advanced in silence, his body barely displacing the mist, his feet making little or no impression on the ground. He felt more like a phantom here than in any of the other meeting places. It was a landscape for such souls, hushed but haunted. He didn't have to walk blindly for long. The mist began to thin out after a time, and through its shreds he caught sight of Chica Jackeen. He dug a chair and small table from the wreckage and was sitting with his back to the great wall of the First Dominion, playing a solitary game of cards and talking furiously to himself as he did so. "We're all crazies," Gentle thought, catching him like this. "Tick Raw, half mad on mustard. Scopeek, become an amateur arsonist. Athanasius marking sacramental sandwiches with his pierced hands. And finally, Chica Jackeen chattering away to himself like a neurotic monkey. Crazies to a man. And of all of them, he, Gentle, was probably the craziest. The lover of a creature that defied the definitions of gender. The maker of a man who had destroyed nations. The only sanity in his life, burning like a clear white light, was that which came from God. The simple purpose of a reconciler. "Jackeen?" The man looked up from his cards somewhat guiltily.
"Oh, Maestro, you're here."
"Don't say you weren't expecting me."
"Not so soon. Is it time for us to go to the Anna?"
"Not yet. I came to be sure you were ready."
"I am, Maestro, truly."
"Were you winning?"
"I was playing myself."
"That doesn't mean you can't win."
"No? No, as you say." "Then yes, I was winning."
He rose from the table, taking off the spectacles he'd been wearing to study his cards. "Has anything come out of the erasure while you've been waiting?"
"No, not come out. In fact, yours is the first voice I've heard since Athanasius left."
"He's part of the Synod now," Gentle said. "Scopeek induced him to join us, to represent the Second."
"What happened to the Yehotemic?" "Not murdered."
"He died of old age."
"Will Athanasius be equal to the task?"
Jackeen asked. Then, thinking his question overstepped the bounds of protocol, he said,
"I'm sorry, I have no right to question your judgment in this."
"You've every right," Gentle said. "We've got to have complete faith in each other."
"If you trust Athanasius, then so do I,"
Jackeen said simply. "So we're ready."
"There is one thing I'd like to report, if I may."
"What's that?"
"I said nothing's come out of the erasure, and that's true."
"But something went in?"
"Yes. Last night, I was sleeping under the table here."
He pointed to his bed of blankets and stone.
"And I woke chilled to the marrow. I wasn't sure whether I was dreaming at first, so I was slow to get up. But when I did, I saw these figures coming out of the fog. Dozens of them."
"Who were they?"
"Nullianax,"
Jackeen said.
"Are you familiar with them?"
"Certainly."
"I counted 50 at least, just within sight of me."
"Did they threaten you?"
"I don't think they even saw me. They had their eyes on their destination."
"The first?"
"That's right. But before they crossed over, they shed their clothes and made some fires, and burned every last thing they wore or brought with them."
"All of them did this?"
"Every one that I saw. It was extraordinary."
"Can you show me the fires?"
"Easily,"
Jackeen said, and led Gentle away from the table, talking as he went.
"I'd never seen a Nullianax before, but of course I've heard the stories."
"They're brutes," Gentle said. "I killed one in Vanief a few months ago, and then I met one of its brothers in Isordorex, and it murdered a child I knew."
"They like innocence, I've heard. It's meat and drink to them, and they're all related to each other, though nobody's ever seen the female of the species. In fact, some say there isn't one."
"You seem to know a lot about them."
"Well, I read a good deal,"
Jackeen said, glancing at Gentle.
"But you know what they say? Study nothing except in the knowledge
that you already knew it."
"That's right."
Gentle looked at the man with fresh interest, hearing the old saw from his lips. Was it so commonplace a dictum that every student had it by heart? Or did Chica Jackeen know the significance of what he was saying? Gentle stopped walking, and Jackeen stopped beside him, offering a smile that verged on the mischievous. Now it was Gentle who did the studying. His text, the other man's face, and reading, saw the dictum proved.
"My God," he said. "Lucius?"
Yes, maestro, it's me.
Lucius, Lucius! The years had taken their toll, of course, though not insufferably. While the face in front of him was no longer that of the eager acolyte he had sent from Gamut Street, it was not marked by more than a tenth of the 2 centuries in between.
"This is extraordinary," Gentle said. "I thought maybe you knew who I was, and you were playing a game with me."
"How could I know?
Am I really so different?"
the other said, clearly a little deflated.
"It took me 23 years to master the fate of holding, but I thought I'd caught the last of my youth before it went entirely. A little vanity, forgive me."
"When did you come here?"
"It seems like a lifetime. So it probably is. I wandered back and forth through the dominions first, studying with one evocator after another, but I was never content with any of them. I had you to judge them by, you see, so I was always dissatisfied."
"I was a lousy teacher," Gentle said.
"Not at all. You taught me the fundamentals, and I've lived by them and prospered. Maybe not in the world's eyes, but in mine."
"The only lesson I gave you was on the stairs. Remember that last night?"
"Of course I remember. The laws of study, workings, and fear. Wonderful."
"But they weren't mine, Lucius. The mischief taught them to me. I just passed them along."
"Isn't that what most teachers do?"
"I think the great ones refine wisdom. They don't simply repeat it. I refined nothing. I thought every word I uttered was perfect because it was falling from my lips."
"So my idol has feet of clay?"
"I'm afraid so."
"You think I didn't know that? I saw what happened at the retreat. I saw you fail, and it's because of that I've waited here."
"I don't follow."
"I knew you wouldn't accept failure. You'd wait, and you'd plan, and someday, even if it took 1,000 years, you'd come back to try again."
"One of these days I'll tell you how it really happened, and you won't be so impressed."
"However it went, you're here," Lucius said, "and I have my dream at last."
"Which is what?"
"To work with you, to join you in the Anna, maestro to maestro."
He grinned.
"God is in his heaven today," he said. "If I'm ever happier than this, it'll kill me. Ah, there, maestro."
He stopped and pointed to the ground a few yards from them.
"That's one of the Nullianax's fires."
The place was blasted, but there were some remains of the Nullianax robes among the ashes. Gentle approached. "I don't have the wherewithal to sort through them, Lucius. Will you do it for me?" Lucius obliged, stooping to turn over the cinders and pluck out what remained of the clothes. There were fragments of suits, robes, and coats in a variety of styles, one finely embroidered after the fashion of Parashokwa, another barely more than sackcloth, a third with medals attached, as if its owner had been a soldier.
"They must have come from all over the Imagica," Gentle said. "Summoned," Lucius replied.
"That seems like a reasonable assumption."
"But why?"
Gentle mused a moment. "I think the Unbeheld has taken them into his furnace, Lucius. He's burned them away."
"So he's wiping the dominions clean?"
"Yes, he is. And the Nullianax knew it. They threw off their clothes like penitents because they knew that they were going to their judgment."
"You see," Lucius said, "you are wise."
"When I'm gone, will you burn even these last pieces?"
"Of course."
"It's his will that we cleanse this place."
"I'll start right away."
"And I'll go back to the Fifth and finish my preparations."
"Is the retreat still standing?"
"Yes, but that's not where I'll be. I've returned to Gamut Street."
"That was a fine house."
"It's still fine in its way. I saw you there on the stairs only a few nights ago."
"A spirit there, and flesh here? What could be more perfect?"
"Being flesh and spirit in the whole of creation," Gentle said.
"Yes, that will be finer still."
"And it'll happen. It's all one, Lucius."
"I hadn't forgotten that lesson."
"Good.
But if I may ask..."
"Yes?"
"Would you call me Chica Jackeen from now on? I've lost the bloom of youth, so I may as well lose the name."
"Maestro Jackeen it is."
"Thank you."
"I'll see you in a few hours," Gentle said, and with that put his thoughts to his return. This time there were no diversions or loiterings, for sentiment's sake or any other. He went at the speed of his intention back through Isordrex and along the Lenten Way, over the Cradle and the benighted heights of the Jokalela, passing across the Mount of Lipabayak and Patashokwa, within whose gates he had yet to step, finally returning into the fifth to the room he'd left in Gamut Street. Day was at the window, and Clem was at the door, patiently awaiting the return of his maestro. As soon as he saw a flicker of animation in Gentle's face, he began to speak, his message too urgent to be delayed a second longer than it had to be. "Monday's back," he said. Gentle stretched and yawned. His nape and lumbar regions ached, and his bladder was ready to burst, but at least he hadn't returned to discover his bowels had given out, as Tick Raw had predicted. "Good," he said. He got to his feet and hobbled to the mantelpiece, clinging to it as he kicked some life back into his deadened legs. "Did he get all the stones?"
"Yes, he did, but I'm afraid Jude didn't come back with him."
"Where the hell is she?"
"He won't tell me. He's got a message from her, he says, but he won't trust it to anyone but you. Do you want to speak to him? He's downstairs eating breakfast."
"Yes, send him up, will you? And if you can, find me something to eat. Anything but sausages."
Clem headed off down the stairs, leaving Gentle to cross to the window and throw it open. The last morning that the fifth would see unreconciled had dawned, and the temperature was already high enough to wilt the leaves on the tree outside. Hearing Monday's feet clattering up the stairs, Gentle turned to greet the messenger, who appeared with a half-eaten hamburger in one hand and a half-smoked cigarette in the other.
"You've got something to tell me?" he said.
"Yes, boss. From Jude."
"Where did she go?"
"Isorderex. That's part of what I'm supposed to tell you. She's gone to Isorderex."
"Did you see her go?"
"Not exactly. She made me stand outside while she went, so that's what I did."
"And the rest of the message?"
"She told me..."
He made a great show of concentration now.
"To tell you where she'd gone, and I've done that. Then she said to tell you that the reconciliation isn't safe, and that you weren't to do nothing until she contacted you again."
"Isn't safe? Those were her words?"
"That's what she said. No kidding."
"Do you know what she was talking about?"
"Search me, boss."
His eyes had gone from Gentle to the darkest corner of the room.
"I didn't know you had a monkey," he said. "Did you bring it back with you?"
Gentle looked to the corner. Little Ease was there, staring up at the maestro fretfully, having presumably crept down into the meditation room sometime during the night.
"Does it eat hamburgers?"
Monday said, going down on his haunches.
"You can try," Gentle said distractedly.
"Monday, is that all Jude said? It isn't safe."
"That's it, boss. I swear."
"She'd just arrived at the retreat and told you she wasn't coming back?"
"Oh no, she took her time," Monday said,
pulling a face as the creature he'd taken to be an ape skulked from its corner and started towards the proffered hamburger. He made to stand up, but it bared its teeth in a grin of such ferocity he thought better of doing so, and simply extended his arm as far as he could to keep the beast from his face. Little Ease slowed as it came within sniffing distance, and, instead of snatching the meal, claimed it from Monday's hand with the greatest delicacy, pinkies raised.
"Will you finish the story?" Gentle said.
"Oh, yeah. Well, there was this fella in the retreat when we got there, and she had a long jaw with him."
"This was somebody she knew?"
"Oh, yeah."
"Who?"
"I forget his name," Monday said,
but seeing Gentle's brow frown, protested.
"That wasn't part of the message, boss. If it had been, I'd have remembered."
"Remember anyway," Gentle said, beginning to suspect conspiracy. "Who was he?"
Monday stood up and drew nervously on his cigarette.
"I don't recall. There were all these birds, you know, and bees and stuff. I wasn't really listening. It was something short like Cody or Coward or..."
"Dowd."
"Yeah, that's it. It was Dowd, and he was really fucked up, let me tell you."
"But alive?"
"Oh yeah, for a while. Like I said, they talked together."
"And it was after this that she said she was going to Isorderex?"
"That's right. She told me to bring the stones back to you and the message with them."
"Both of which you've done. Thank you."
"You're the boss, boss,"
Monday said.
"Is that all? If you want me, I'm on the step. It's going to be a scorcher."
He thundered off downstairs.
"Shall I leave the door open, Liberatore?"
Little Ease said, as it nibbled on the hamburger. "What are you doing here?"
"I got lonely up there,"
the creature said.
"You promised obedience," Gentle reminded it.
"You don't trust her, do you?"
Little Ease replied. "You think she's gone off to join Sartori?" He hadn't until now, but the notion, now that it was floated, didn't seem so improbable. Jude had confessed what she felt for Sartori in this very house, and clearly believed that he loved her in return. Perhaps she'd simply slipped away from the retreat while Monday's back was turned and had gone to find the father of her child. If that was the case, it was paradoxical behaviour to seek out the arms of a man whose enemy she'd just helped towards victory. But this was not a day to waste analysing such conundrums. She'd done what she'd done, and there was an end to it. Gentle hoisted himself up onto the sill, from which perch he'd often planned his itinerary, and attempted to push all thoughts of her defection out of his head. This was a bad room in which to try and forget her, however. It was, after all, the womb in which she'd been made. The boards most likely still concealed motes of the sand that had marked her circle, and stains, deep in their grain, of the liquors he'd anointed her nakedness with. Try as he might to keep the thoughts from coming, one led inevitably to another. Imagining her naked, he pictured his hands upon her, slick with oils, then his kisses, then his body. And before a minute had passed, he was sitting on the sill with an erection nuzzling against his underwear. Of all the mornings to be plagued with such distraction, the beguilements of the flesh had no place in the work ahead of him. They'd brought the last reconciliation to tragedy, and he would not allow them to lead him from his sanctified path by a single step. He looked down at his groin, disgusted with himself.
"Cut it off,"
Little Ease advised. If he could have done the deed without making an invalid of himself, he'd have done so there and then, and gladly. He had nothing but contempt for what rose between his legs. It was a hot-headed idiot, and he wanted rid of it. "I can control it," he replied.
"Famous last words,"
the creature said. A blackbird had come into the tree and was singing blithely there. He looked its way and beyond up through the branches into the burnished blue sky. His thoughts abstracted as he studied it, and by the time he heard Clem coming up the stairs with food and drink, the spasm of carnality had passed, and he greeted his angels with a cooling brow.
"So now we wait," he told Clem.
"What for?"
"For Jude to come back."
"And if she doesn't?"
"She will," Gentle replied. "This is where she was born. It's her home, even if she wishes it weren't. She'll have to make her way back here eventually. And if she's conspired against us, Clem, if she's working with the enemy, then I swear I'll draw a circle right here," he pointed to the boards, "and I'll unmake her so well it'll be as though she never drew breath."
Chapter 19. 1. The law-defying waters were compassionate. Though they carried Jude through the palace at considerable speed, roaming through corridors their passage had already stripped of tapestries and furnishings, they treated their cargo with care. She wasn't thrown against the walls or the pillars, but was borne up on a ship of surf that neither faltered nor foundered, but hurried, remotely helmed, to its destination. That place could scarcely be in doubt. The mystery at the heart of the autarch's maze had always been the pivot tower, and though she'd witnessed the beginning of the tower's undoing, it was still, surely, her place of debarkation. Prayers and petitions had gone there for an age, attracted by the pivot's authority. Whatever force had replaced it, calling these waters, it had set its throne on the rubble of the fallen lord. And now she had proof of that, as the waters carried her out of the naked corridors and into the still severer environs of the tower, slowing to deliver her into a pool so thick with detritus it was almost solid. Out of this wreckage rose a staircase, and she hauled herself from the debris and lay on the lower steps, giddy but exhilarated. The waters continued to surge around the staircase like an eager spring tide, and their clear desire to be up the flight was contagious. She got to her feet after a little time and proceeded to climb. Although there were no lights burning at the top, there was plenty of illumination spilling down the stairs to meet her, and like the light at the springing places, it was prismatic, suggesting there were more waters ahead that had come into the palace via other routes. Before she was even halfway up the flight, two women appeared and stared down at her. Both were dressed in simple, off-white shifts, the fatter of the pair,
A woman of gargantuan proportions unbuttoned to bare her breasts to the baby she was nursing. She looked almost as infantile as her charge, her hair wispy, her face, like her breasts, heavy and sugar-almond pink. The woman beside her was older and slimmer, her skin substantially darker than that of her companion, her grey hair braided and combed out to her shoulders like a cowl. She wore gloves and glasses, and regarded Jude with almost professorial detachment.
"Another soul saved from the flood," she said.
Jude had stopped climbing. Though neither woman had made any sign that she was forbidden entry, she wanted to come into this miraculous place as a guest, not a trespasser.
"Am I welcome?"
"Of course," said the mother. "Have you come to meet the goddesses?"
"Yes."
"Are you from the Bastion, then?"
Before Jude could reply, her companion supplied the answer.
"Of course not. Look at her. But the waters brought her."
"The waters'll bring any woman who dares. They brought us, didn't they?"
"Are there many others?"
Jude asked.
"Hundreds," came the reply. "Maybe thousands by now."
Jude wasn't surprised. If someone like herself, a stranger in the Dominions, had come to suspect that the goddesses were still extant, how much more hopeful must the women who lived here have been, living with the legends of Tisha Lulay and Jokalelal. When Jude reached the top of the stairs, the bespectacled woman introduced herself.
"I'm Lottie Yap."
"I'm Judith."
"We're pleased to see you, Judith," the other woman said. "I'm Parimarola. And this fellow," she looked down at the baby, "is Billo."
"Yours?" Jude asked.
"Now where would I have found a man to give me the likes of this?"
Parimarola said.
"We've been in the annex for 9 years," Lottie Yap explained. "Guests of the Ortark."
"May his thorn rot and his berries wither," Parimarola added.
"And where have you come from?"
Lottie asked.
"The fifth," Jude said.
She was not fully attending to the women now, however. Her interest had been claimed by a window that lay across the puddle-strewn corridor behind them, or rather, by the vista visible through it. She went to the sill, both awed and astonished, and gazed out at an extraordinary spectacle. The flood had cleared a circle half a mile wide or more in the centre of the palace, sweeping walls and pillars and roofs away and drowning the rubble. All that was left, rising from the waters, were islands of rock where the taller towers had stood, and here and there a corner of one of the palace's vast amphitheatres, preserved as if to mock the overweening pretensions of its architect. Even these fragments would not stand for much longer, she suspected. The waters circled this immense basin without violence, but their sheer weight would soon bring these last remnants of Sartori's masterwork down. At the centre of this small sea was an island larger than the rest, its lower shores made up of the half-demolished chambers that had clustered around the pivot tower, its rocks the rubble of that tower's upper half, mingled with vast pieces of its tenant, and its height the remains of the tower itself, a ragged but glittering pyramid of rubble in which a white fire seemed to be burning. Looking at the transformation these waters had wrought, eroding in a matter of days, perhaps hours, what the Ortark had taken decades to devise and build, Jude wondered that she'd reached this place intact. The power she'd first encountered on the lower slopes as an innocent, if willful, brook was here revealed as an awesome force for change.
"Were you here when this happened?" she asked Lottie Yap.
"We saw only the end of it," she replied. "But it was quite a sight, let me tell you, seeing the towers fall."
"We were afraid for our lives," Parimarola said.
"Speak for yourself," Lottie replied. "The waters didn't set us free just to drown us. We were prisoners in the annex, you see. Then the floor cracked open and the waters just bubbled up and washed the walls away."
"We knew the goddesses would come, didn't we?"
Parimarola said. "We always had faith in that."
"So you never believed they were dead?"
"Of course not. Buried alive, maybe. Sleeping. Even lunatic. But never dead."
"What she says is right," Lottie observed. "We knew this day would come."
"Unfortunately, it may be a short victory," Jude said.
"Why do you say that?" Lottie replied. "The Ortark's gone."
"Yes. But his father hasn't."
"His father?" said Parimarola. "I thought he was a bastard."
"Who's his father, then?" said Lottie.
"Hapexamendios."
Paramarola laughed at this, but Lottie Yap nudged in her well-padded ribs.
"It's not a joke, Rola." "It has to be," the other protested. "Do you see the woman laughing?"
Then to Jude,
"Do you have any evidence for this?"
"No, I don't."
"Then where'd you get such an idea?"
Jude had guessed it would be difficult to persuade people of Sartori's origins, but she'd optimistically supposed that when the moment came she'd be possessed by a sudden lucidity. Instead, she felt a rage of frustration. If she was obliged to unravel the whole sorry history of her involvement with the autarch Sartori to every soul who stood between her and the goddesses, the worst would be upon them all before she was halfway there. Then, inspiration.
"The pivot's the proof," she said.
"How so?"
said Lottie, who was now studying this woman the flood had brought to their feet with fresh intensity.
"He could never have moved the pivot without his father's collaboration."
"But the pivot doesn't belong to the unbeheld," Paramarola said. "It never did."
Jude looked confounded.
"What Rola says is true," Lottie told her. "He may have used it to control a few weak men, but the pivot was never his."
"Whose then?"
Umagamagai was in it."
"And who's that?"
"The sister of Tishalule and Jokalela, half-sister of the Daughters of the Delta."
"There was a goddess in the pivot."
"Yes."
"And the autarch didn't know it?"
"That's right. She hid herself there to escape Hapexamendios when he passed through the Imagica. Jokalela went into the snow and was lost there. Tishalule
in the cradle of Jasemit," Jude said.
"Yes, indeed," said Lottie, plainly impressed. "And Umagamagai hid herself in solid rock," Paramarola went on, telling the tale as though to a child, "thinking he'd pass over the place, not seeing her. But he chose the pivot as the centre of the Imagica and laid his power upon it, sealing her in."
This was surely the ultimate irony, Jude thought. The architect of Isordorex had built his fortress, indeed his entire empire, around an imprisoned goddess. Nor was the parallel with Celestine lost on her. It seemed Roxburgh had been unwittingly working in a grim tradition when he'd sealed Celestine up beneath his house.
"Where are the goddesses now?"
Jude asked Lottie.
"On the island. We'll all be allowed into their presence, in time, and we'll be blessed by them. But it'll take days."
"I don't have days," Jude said. "How do I get to the island?"
"You'll be called when your time comes."
"That has to be now," Jude said, "or it'll be never."
She looked left and right along the passageway.
"Thank you for the education," she said. "Maybe I'll see you again."
Choosing right over left, she made to leave, but Lottie took hold of her sleeve.
"You don't understand, Judith," she said. "The goddesses have come to make us safe. Nothing can harm us here, not even the unbeheld."
"I hope that's true," Jude said. "To the bottom of my heart, I hope that's true, but I have to warn them in case it isn't."
"Then we'd better come with you," Lottie said. "You'll never find your way otherwise."
"Wait," Paramarola said. "Should we be doing this? She may be dangerous."
"Aren't we all?" Lottie replied. "That's why they locked us away in the first place, remember?"
2. If the atmosphere of the streets outside the palace had suggested some post-apocalyptic carnival, the waters dancing, the children laughing, the air pavonine, then that sense was 100 times stronger in the passageways around the rim of the flood-scarred basin. There were children here too, their laughter more musical than ever. None was over 5 or so, but there were both boys and girls in the throng. They turned the corridors into playgrounds, their din echoing off walls that had not heard such joy since they'd been raised. There was also water, of course. Every inch of ground was blessed by a puddle, a rivulet, or a stream. Every arch had a liquid curtain cascading from its keystone. Every chamber was refreshed by burbling springs and roof-grazing fountains. And in every tinkling trickle there was the same sentience that Jude had felt in the tide that had brought her up here. Water as life, filled to the last drop with the purpose of the goddesses. Overhead, the comet was at its height and sent its straight, white beams through any chink it could find, turning the humblest puddle into an oracular pool and platting its light into the gush of every spout. The women in these glittering corridors came in all shapes and sizes. Many, Lottie explained, were like themselves, former prisoners of the bastion or its dreaded annex. Others had simply found their way up the hill following their instincts and the streams, leaving their husbands, dead or alive, below.
"Are there no men here at all?"
"Only the little ones," said Lottie.
"They're all little ones," Paramarola observed.
"There was a captain at the annex who was a brute," Lottie said, "and when the waters came he must have been emptying his bladder, because his body floated by our cell with his trousers unbuttoned."
"And, you know, he was still holding on to his manhood," Paramarola said. "He had the choice between that and swimming,
and instead of letting go, he drowned," Lottie said. This entertained Paramarola no end, and she laughed so hard the baby's mouth was dislodged from her teat. Milk spurted in the child's face, which brought a further round of merriment. Jude didn't ask how Paramarola came to be so nourishing when she was neither the mother of the child nor, presumably, pregnant. It was just one of the many enigmas this journey showed her. Like the pool that clung to one of the walls, filled to brimming with luminous fish, or the waters that imitated fire, from which some of the women had made crowns, or the immensely long eel she saw carried past, its gaping head on a child's shoulder, its body looped between half a dozen women, back and forth across their shoulders 10 times or more. If she'd requested an explanation for any one of these sights, she'd have been obliged to inquire about them all, and they'd never have got more than a few yards down the corridor. The journey brought them at last to a place where the waters had carved out a shallow pool at the edge of the main basin, served by several rivulets that climbed through rubble to fill it to brimming, its overflow running into the basin itself. In it and around it were perhaps 30 women and children, some playing, some talking, but most, their clothes shed, waiting silently in the pool, gazing out across the turbulent waters of the basin to Uma Umagamagai's island. Even as Jude and her guides approached the place, a wave broke against the lip of the pool, and 2 women, standing there hand in hand, went with it as it withdrew and were carried away towards the island. There was an eroticism about the scene which in other circumstances Jude would certainly have denied she felt. But here such priggishness seemed redundant, even ludicrous. She allowed her imagination to wonder what it would be like to sink into the midst of this nakedness, where the only scrap of masculinity was between the legs of a suckling infant, to brush breast to breast and let her fingers be kissed and her neck be caressed, and kiss and caress in her turn.
"The water in the basin's very deep," Lottie said at her side. "It goes all the way down into the mountain."
What had happened to the dead, Jude wondered, whose company Dowd had found so educative? Had the waters sluiced them away, along with the invocations and entreaties that had dropped into that same darkness from beneath the pivot tower? Or had they been dissolved into a single soup, the sex of dead men forgiven, the pain of dead women healed, and, all mingled with the prayers, become part of this indefatigable flood? She hoped so. If the powers here were to have authority against the unbeheld, they would have to reclaim every forsaken strength they could. The walls between Kesperates had already been dragged down, and the plashing streams were making a continuum of city and palace. But the past had to be reclaimed as well, and whatever miracles it had boasted, surely there had been some, even here, preserved. This was more than an abstract desire on Jude's part. She was, after all, one of those miracles, made in the image of the woman who'd ruled here with as much ferocity as her husband.
"Is this the only way of getting to the island?" she asked Lottie.
"There aren't ferries, if that's what you mean."
"I'd better start swimming, then," Jude said.
Her clothes were an encumbrance, but she wasn't yet so easy with herself that she could strip off on the rocks and go into the waters naked. So with a brief thanks to Lottie and Paramarola, she started to climb down the tumble of blocks that surrounded the pool.
"I hope you're wrong, Judith," Lottie called after her. "So do I," Jude replied. "Believe me, so do I."
Both this exchange and her ungainly descent drew the puzzled gaze of several of the bathers, but none made any objection to her appearing in their midst. The closer she got to the waters of the basin, the more anxious she became about the crossing, however. It was several years since she'd swum any distance, and she doubted she'd have the strength to resist the currents and eddies if they chose to keep her from her destination. But they wouldn't drown her, surely. They'd borne her all the way up here, after all, sweeping her through the palace unharmed. The only difference between this journey and that, though it was a profound one, to be sure, was the depth of the water. Another wave was approaching the lip of the pool, and there was a woman and child floating forward to take it. Before they could do so, she took a running jump off the boulder she was perched on, clearing the heads of the bathers below by a hair's breadth, and plunging into the tide. It wasn't so much a dive as a plummet, and it took her deep. She flailed wildly to right herself, opening her eyes but unable to decide which way was up. The waters knew. They lifted her out of their depths, like a cork, and threw her up into the spume. She was already 20 yards or more from the rocks, and being carried away at speed. She had time to glimpse Lottie searching for her in the surf, then the eddies turned her around and around again, until she no longer knew the direction in which the pool lay. Instead, she fixed her eyes on the island and began to swim as best she could towards it. The waters seemed content to supplement her efforts with energies of their own, though they were describing a spiral around the island, and as they carried her closer to its shore, they also swept her in a counterclockwise motion around it. The comet's light fell on the waves all around her, and its glitter kept the depths from sight, which she was glad of. Buoyed up though she was, she didn't want to be reminded of the pit beneath her. She put all her will into the business of swimming, not even allowing herself to enjoy the roiling of the waters against her body. Such luxury, like the questions she'd wanted to ask as she'd walked with Lottie and Paramarola, was for another day. The shore was within 50 yards of her now, but her strokes became increasingly irrelevant the closer to the island she came. As the spiral tightened, the tide became more authoritative, and she finally gave up any attempt at self-propulsion and surrendered herself utterly to the hold of the waters. They carried her around the island twice before she felt her feet scraping the steeply inclined rocks beneath the surge, presenting her with a fine, if giddying, view of Uma Umagamagai's temple. Not surprisingly, the waters had been more inspired here than in any other spot she'd seen. They'd worked at the blocks of which the tower was built, monumental though they were, eroding the mortar between them, then eating at them top and bottom, replacing their severity with mathematics of undulation. Slabs of stone, the height of masons who'd first carved them, were no longer locked together, but balanced like acrobats, one corner laid against another, while radiant water ran through the cavities and carried on its work of turning the once impregnable tower into a wedded column of water, stone, and light. The eroded moats had run off in the rivulets and been deposited on the shore as a fine, soft sand, in which Jude lay when she emerged from the basin, given a giggling welcome by a quartet of children playing nearby. She allowed herself only a minute to catch her breath, then she got to her feet and started up the beach towards the temple. Its doorway was as elaborately eroded as the blocks, a veil of bright water concealing the interior from those waiting nearby. There were perhaps a dozen women at the threshold. One, a girl barely past pubescence, was walking on her hands. Somebody else seemed to be singing, but the music was so close to the sound of running water that Jude couldn't decide whether a voice was flowing or some stream was aspiring to melody. As at the pool, nobody objected to her sudden appearance, nor remarked on the fact that she was weighed down by waterlogged clothes while they were in various states of undress. A benign languor was on them all, and had it not been for Jude's willpower, she might have let it claim her too. She didn't hesitate, however, but stepped through the water door without so much as a murmur to those waiting at the threshold. Inside there was no solid sight to greet her. Instead, the air was filled with forms of light, folding and unfolding as though invisible hands were performing a lucid origami. They weren't working towards petty resemblance, but transforming their radiant stuff over and over, each new shape on its way to becoming another before it was fixed. She looked down at her arms. They were still visible, but not as flesh and blood.
They'd learned the trick of the light already, and were blossoming into a multiplicity of forms in order to join the play. She reached out to touch one of her fellow visitors with her burgeoning fingers, and, brushing her, caught a glimpse of the woman from whom this origami had emerged. She appeared the way a body might if a damp sheet billowed against it, momentarily clinging to the shape of her hip, her cheek, her breast, then billowing again and snatching the glimpse away. But there'd been a smile there. She was certain of that. Reassured that she was neither alone nor unwelcome here, she began to advance into the temple. The promise of eroticism she'd first felt as she gazed into the pool was now realized. She felt the forms of her own body spreading like milk dropped into the fluid air and grazing the bodies of those she was passing between. Musings, most no more than half-formed, mingled with the sensation. Perhaps she would dissolve here and flow out through the walls to join the waters around the islands, or perhaps she was already in that sea and the flesh and blood she thought she'd owned was just a figment of those waters, conjured to comfort the lonely land. Or perhaps. These speculations were not divorced from the brushing of form against form, but were part of the pleasure, her nerves bearing these fruits, which in turn made her more tender to the touches of her companions. They were falling away as she advanced, she realized. Her progress was taking her up into the heights of the temple. If there had been solid ground beneath her feet, she'd lost all sense of it as she crossed the threshold and rose without effort, her stuff possessed of the same law-defying genius as had been the waters below. There was another motion ahead and above her, more sinuous than the forms she'd met at the door, and she rose towards it as if summoned, praying that when the moment came she'd have the words and lips to shape the thoughts in her head. The motion was getting clearer, and if she'd had any doubt below as to whether these sights were imagined or seen, she now had such dichotomies swept away. She was both seeing with her imagination, and imagining she saw the glyph that hung in the air in front of her, a Möbius strip of light-haunted water, a steady rhythm passing through its seamless loop and throwing off waves of brilliant colour, which shed bright rains around her. Here was the raiser of springs, here was the summoner of rivers, here was the sublime presence whose strength had brought the palace to rubble and made a home for oceans and children where there'd only been terror before. Here was Uma Umagamagai. Though she studied the goddess's glyph, Jude could see no hint of anything that breathed, sweated, or corrupted in it. But there was such an emanation of tenderness from the form that, faceless as the goddess was, it seemed to Jude she could feel her smile, her kiss, her loving gaze. And love it was. Though this power knew her not at all, Jude felt embraced and comforted as only love could embrace and comfort. There'd never been a time in her life, until now, when some part of her had not been afraid. It was the condition of being alive that even bliss was attended by the imminence of its decease, but here such terrors seemed absurd. This face loved her unconditionally, and would do so forever.
"Sweet Judith,"
she heard the goddess say, the voice so charged, so resonant, that these few syllables were an aria.
"Sweet Judith, what's so urgent that you risk your life to come here?"
As Uma Umagamagai spoke, Jude saw her own face appearing in the ripples, brightening, then teased out into a thread of light that was run into the goddess's glyph. "She's reading me," Jude thought. "She's trying to understand why I'm here, and when she does, she'll take the responsibility away. I'll be able to stay in this glorious place with her, always."
"So," said the goddess after a time, "this is a grim business. It falls to you to choose between stopping this reconciliation or letting it go on and risking some harm from Hapex Amendios."
"Yes," Jude replied, grateful that she'd been relieved of the need to explain herself.
"I don't know what the Unbeheld is planning. Maybe nothing.
And maybe the end of the Imagicka."
"Could he do that?"
"Very possibly," said Uma Umagamagai. He has done harm to our temples and our sisters many, many times, both in his own person and through his agents. He's a soul in error and lethal. But would he destroy a whole dominion? I can no more predict him than you can,
Umagamagai said.
But I'll mourn if the chance to complete the circle is missed.
The circle, said Jude. What circle?
The circle of the Imagica, the goddess replied. Please understand, sister, the dominions were never meant to be divided this way. That was the work of the first human spirits when they came into their terrestrial life. Nor was there any harm in it at the beginning. It was their way of learning to live in a condition that intimidated them. When they looked up, they saw stars. When they looked down, they saw earth. They couldn't make their mark on what was above, but what was below could be divided and owned and fought over. From that division all others sprang. They lost themselves to territories and nations, all shaped by the other sex, of course, all named by them. They even buried themselves in the earth to have it more utterly, preferring worms to the company of light. They were blinded to the Imagica, and the circle was broken. And Hapexamendios, who was made by the will of these men, grew strong enough to forsake his makers, and so passed from the fifth dominion into the first, murdering goddesses as he went. He did harm, yes, but he could have done greater harm still if he'd known the shape of the Imagica. He could have discovered what mystery it circled, and gone there instead.
What mystery is that?
You're going back into a dangerous place, sweet Judith, and the less you know, the safer you'll be. When the time comes, we will unravel these mysteries together as sisters. Until then, take comfort that the error of the son is also the error of the father, and in time all errors must undo themselves and pass away.
So if they'll solve themselves, Jude said, why do I have to go back to the fifth?
Before Umagamagai could resume speaking, another voice intruded. Particles rose between Jude and the goddess as this other woman spoke, pricking Jude's flesh where they touched, reminding her of a state that knew ice and fire.
"Why do you trust this woman?" the stranger said.
"Because she came to us open-hearted, Jokalela," the goddess replied. "How open-hearted is a woman who treads dry-eyed in the place where her sister died?" Jokalela said. "How open-hearted is a woman who comes into our presence without shame when she has the Ortax Artoris child in her womb?"
"We have no place for shame here," Umagamagai said.
"You may have no place,"
Jokalela said, rising into view now.
"I have plenty."
Like her sister, Jokalela was here in her essential form, a more complex shape than that of Umagamagai, and less pleasing to the eye because the motions that ran in it were more hectic, her form not so much rippling as boiling, shedding its pricking darts as it did so.
"Shame is wholly appropriate for a woman who has lain with one of our enemies," she said.
Despite the intimidation Jude felt from the goddess, she spoke out in her own defense.
"It's not as simple as that," she said,
her courage fueled by the frustration she felt, having this intruder spoil the congress between herself and Umagamagai.
"I didn't know he was the Ortak."
"Who did you imagine he was? Or didn't you care?"
The exchange might have escalated, but that Umagamagai